This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
If you're ready for a new job, let Express Employment Professionals help you. Express is already hiring for summer jobs in a variety of industries. Job seekers never pay a fee at Express. Go to expresspros.com to find your location. That's expresspros.com.
Please join me in welcoming Chief Justice Roberts and Judge Velarde.
You see, I told you they like me. Well, it's really is an honor to be here with you and to rekindle our old friendship that started what, 47 years ago.
Wow! Yeah,
long time.
You haven't aged a bit.
No, you haven't. You haven't changed a bit. So folks from Buffalo are very proud to say that you're a native son here. You spent the first 10 years of your life in Hamburg.
Right.
What do you remember about growing up in Buffalo?
It's cold. the memories were refreshed earlier this morning. I went back and visited my boyhood home, which was a lot smaller than I remember. It was near the fairgrounds, for those of you around here, and we would... I remember hearing the call to the post, you know, the dun 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 when they were, because they did racing there on the weekends. We would set up lawn chairs in the driveway because well, they had concerts too, and got the concert without having to pay for it. So,
where'd you go to school?
St. Bernadette's.
Yeah. And that's where my wedding was.
So. Oh.
Yeah. So we have that.
It closed last week.
Yeah, that's what I heard. So when we were in law school, and particularly on the Law Review, people saw you as very bright, a good writer, ambitious, and going places. Did you let yourself dream about being on the Supreme Court then?
No. I didn't dream about being a judge. I didn't dream about being a lawyer before then. I was going to go to graduate school to study in history, true story, I was taking a cab back from Logan Airport to the campus, and the cab driver asked me what I did. I told him I was a history major at Harvard. He said, I was a history major at Harvard. And I said, where's that law school application file? When I got to law school, I found out that I liked it, but I certainly didn't want to be a judge. Ended up clerking and working at in the government and in a law firm for a while. It just sort of happened that you end up in a position where someone decides to nominate you to be a judge. And by that time, I had been practicing long enough that I thought it would be a good change, and that worked out. And then, the Supreme Court fortuitously came along after that.
So your career started as and was by and large as an appellate lawyer. How did that happen?
Well, I came off the government work that I had been doing. I had spent a total of 7 years between the clerkships and a stint in the Justice Department and some time at the White House Counsel's Office. So when I left that, I'd been out 7 or 8 years and hadn't really practiced normal law. And I didn't want to start, you know, a seminar or whatever for first-year students to learn how to take a deposition. So I went around at law firms, and they'd say, what do you want to do? I said, well, the one thing I thought I could do, I said, I want to do appellate work. And they said, oh, okay, you know, if the case you're handling goes on appeal, you can do appellate work. And I said, no, I only want to do appellate work. And nobody was buying that until I ran into a fellow named Barrett Prettyman, who that's what he did. It was at the firm of Hogan and Hartson. He was an amazing, amazing man. And I decided I would like to work with him, and that was fine with him. He had been an extraordinary life. The courthouse in D.C. is named after his father, who was a very prominent judge. But Barrett, at age 18, left high school in D.C. and went to England and then joined Patton's army, hurtling toward Berlin. They were ambushed, and his unit found themselves in these foxholes, terrible cold through the night, and the Germans were sort of picking them off sort of one by one. And he swore that if he made it to the morning, he would wake up happy every day. And he made it through. He had frostbite. They took him back to the back to Belgium. His the rest of his unit went in, and they were going right into the Battle of the Bulge, and they were all killed. So he kept his vow, as far as I could tell. It was a very upbeat person, very, very, pretty much everybody else on their law walls had pictures of, fox hunting or old English judges. And, he had pictures of clients like Truman Capote and Catherine Ann Porter and and he had a great attitude, and I really enjoyed practicing law with him.
And he woke up happy every day, even after he started working with you?
Yeah. I never heard that. Yeah.
So I said you were a hard worker on the Law Review, and you really were, but you had some time for fun as well. And I told Tom Metzloff, who's a law professor at Duke, yeah, that I would ask you to tell these folks about pencil ball.
Yeah, Tom and I spent more time playing pencil ball at the Law Review than working on the Law Review stuff. It was a very complicated thing. You get a little piece of paper and put some tape around it, and then with pencils, somebody would pitch the ball and you'd try to hit it with a pencil.
And you have this elaborate scoring system too, right? A triple, if you got in the wastebasket, it was a triple.
Right.
If it ended up sticking to the ceiling, it was a homer, I forget.
Well, it was very complicated.
They never let me play.
The rules evolved as each game went on.
I was an underclassman, so they never let me play. But they played the pencil ball game. So you interviewed for clerkships yourself, and you now interview candidates for clerkships. Any pointers you have for folks when they interview?
Well, one year when I was interviewing people, I was looking at, with law clerks, and probably you do as well, you want people with some degree of self-reliance and confidence. So I thought, laid out a dozen half-glazed and half-powdered donuts out in the waiting area. And I figured, one, it would be a good sign if whoever it was liked donuts. And also, if they had enough self-assurance to have one, even though their hands would have glazing or powder on them when they came in. End of the day, a dozen donuts still there. So everybody failed that. Now, I had some bad experiences of my own. It was back when some justices were still hiring people right out of law school, and Justice White was one of them, and I was scheduled for an interview with him. And I went down to Washington, and they had just opened the new metro system, just opened, and you put your money in and you get a fare card and all that. I don't think they do this anymore. I'm sure they fixed it back then, but all I had was a 20, and put it in and got put in the fare. It was 40 cents to Union Station, so I got $19.60 in quarters or whatever. It was like in Las Vegas, the quarters just kept punching out. But, you know, I was a law student. I wasn't going to leave them there.
Right.
So I put some in here in these other pockets. And I walked into Justice White's chambers, and I was jingling. He kind of looked strange at me, you know, and I crossed my legs and $1.50 fell on the floor. I didn't get an offer from him.
Tom Metzloff got that job, right? He clerked.
Tom, my pencil ball opponent, got the job.
Yeah. So you really are a terrific writer, and you were back in law school as well. I still remember you're telling me that if I had a sentence that had three prepositional phrases or more, go back and rewrite the sentence because the sentence needed rewriting. Where'd you learn to write? And is there any one person who you credit for teaching you how to write?
Well, I think the way to learn to write is to read good writing. And I read a lot. I liked Conrad. I liked and Elmore Leonard. I mean, Joseph Conrad, if you want to write long and flowing, elegant sentences, and Elmore Leonard, if you like punchy sentences. And I think that helped a lot. Mm-hmm. When it came to writing briefs, though, I had a secret weapon. I have three sisters. None of them is a lawyer, and yet they're, you know, very bright. And I would send, in most cases, a copy of the draft brief to them and ask them to read it once. And then I'd call them and ask them what it was about and who should win. And if your writing isn't clear enough for somebody who is an intelligent layperson to get through it and to understand, you know, basically what's going on, I mean, you know, they wouldn't say, oh, you know, under ERISA this or that, but they say, you know, the guy who, you know, was driving the truck, you know, should have looked left and he looked right and, you know, the safety brake didn't work so the other person could pay. And if it was the right answer, then, you know, because I see it today and I bet you do too, when you read so many briefs and read them carefully, but it's not like you can devote as much attention to, you know, however many cases you're hearing. So you want to make sure that somebody who's going to read through it once, maybe a little more quickly than you'd like, really gets the gist of what you want. The other thing I'd like to do is read aloud. And again, no matter how complicated it was, you should be able to stand up and read it to somebody and have them basically follow. I mean, otherwise your sentences are too convoluted, not direct enough. And I think those are two things that serve me well.
Do you still try to do that now when you write decisions? You try to make them simple?
Yeah, people are always complaining and walking down the halls, and they're reading out loud, and they don't do that.
You what? but you try to make your decisions accessible.
I'll tell you, I mean, it's not, you know, there are cases where, you know, we don't necessarily study every brief, and if you file a brief and you can't, I can't read through it once.
Right.
You know, it's going to, okay, I've got to read through it twice. And, you know, sit down with the law clerk and say, what do you think this is about?
Yeah.
And I think people place too much emphasis on, like, showing off their intellectual sophistication or the nuances instead of just being very direct in your writing. And I always think, particularly in the cert petitions when I was doing those, it's very hard. I don't know what the rate is now, 2% or less than that get granted. I always thought it was important to put something in that would catch somebody's eye. Even I had a case once involving, it was mining in Alaska, and it involved something called the Red Dog Mine, which was out in the middle of Alaska. And so I figured maybe it would help. So I put in the first page and a half is about why it was called the Red Dog Mine. And it was because you get these stories in Alaska where somebody has to fly out to get emergency insulin, and they fly back. And this was flying back, and the guy who had his plane, he always had this red dog, you know, in his plane. And the plane coming back crashes, but the dog, you know, survives. The pilot doesn't. The dog runs to the village, and they, you know, they get the insulin and all that. And then hopefully you read on, and it's about some mining regulations or something. Hear me out. When I got on the court, the first thing Justice O'Connor said to me when we were sitting down for lunch and all said, I love that story about the dog.
Yeah, right. Wow.
Yeah. But I mean, they denied cert, but that, you know, that happens.
But they read it. But they read it.
You knew, yeah. I bet she finished reading it, too.
Yeah. So when I write decisions, I tell my law clerks that, you know, half the people who read the decision are going to think I'm an idiot because they lost. But I want them to at least understand why I'm an idiot, at least why I made the decision that I made in the case. Because I think it's important to write so that it's accessible for people. And judges, you know, do the same thing, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Let's talk about something a little more important, a little more substantive. I think most judges would agree that judicial independence is crucial. Do you agree? What do you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's central. The only real political science innovation in our Constitution, I mean, you know, parliaments have been around for 800 years, and obviously executives, is the establishment of an independent judiciary. Even places you think are similar to ours, like England, the judiciary in England was part of Parliament. I mean, they sat in the House of Lords, and because Parliament was supreme. But in our Constitution, judges and the judiciary is a co-equal branch of government, separate from the others, with the authority to interpret the Constitution as law and strike down, obviously, acts of Congress or acts of the president. And that innovation doesn't work if it's not, the judiciary is not independent. Its job is to obviously decide cases, but in the course of that, check the excesses of Congress or of the executive, and that does require a degree of independence.
What do you think of these calls for impeachment of judges based on the decisions that they've made?
Well, I've already spoken to that, and yeah. You know, impeachment is not how you register disagreement with decisions.
That's what you're for, right? That's what you're there for.
That's what we're there for.
Yeah. So, lots of decisions that you make interpreting the Constitution have real life practical consequences. So, just as a for example, the Second Amendment decisions result in more people having guns. And the Obamacare decision resulted in more people having health insurance. Obergefell resulted in more same-sex marriages. Do you think about those practical consequences when you're interpreting the Constitution? And should justices think about those practical consequences when they're interpreting the words of the Constitution?
Mainly, no. To both of those questions, because if you do that, you know, with one exception I'll talk about later, but if you do that, you're kind of putting yourself in the place of the legislator. You can say, for example, a consequence of the Second Amendment decisions are, well, more people have guns, and so there's more... Yeah. You know, accidental shootings, more shootings. Or you can say the consequence is that more people are armed and therefore they're in a better position if there's foreign invasion, as there was with the British shortly after the adoption of the Second Amendment, so that's a good thing. Now, if you decide one of those or the other based on your view of what you think is best, you would be substituting your own view for that of the people who wrote the Constitution. So, no, I don't think that's not a big part of at least how I do my job, sort of what a purposivist approach is what people would call that, because I think you're making yourself the arbiter of what people were trying to accomplish in that law when you really need to be doing is sitting down and reading it, you know, in its appropriate context and trying to figure out what they meant.
Yeah.
Now, at one extreme, if an interpretation you adopt leads to some absurd result that nobody could plausibly have intended, then the consequences make a difference. But I think it's more important to figure out what the people who wrote the law had in mind and what they meant by the words they used, rather than think, you know, what is this type of legislation for?
Yeah.
Because then the... You know, the interpretation flip-flops.
Yeah. So The courthouse here in Buffalo is named for Robert Jackson, and you clerked for Justice Rehnquist.
Right.
Justice Rehnquist clerked for Justice Jackson, so you're sort of his grandson.
Sort of.
In a way. Yeah. Does that have any special meaning for you? I mean, I know one of the photos, one of the portraits you have hanging, one of the four portraits you have hanging in the
Justices Conference
in the conference room.
Yeah,
is Jackson. Yeah. Would you talk about that a little bit?
Well, sure. I mean, obviously, one of the more remarkable members of the court in our history. Part of the reason he's in our conference room is he was, you know, the Solicitor General who argued before the court, the Attorney General, you know, in charge of the branch of justice and the administration, the prosecutor at Nuremberg, which was very controversial on the court. His colleagues did not think that was necessarily something he should be doing. And obviously one of the great justices. I mean, his eloquence is really extraordinary. His eloquence at Nuremberg was extraordinary. So, yeah, I think it's a great grandfather to have. Now, the other portraits, John Marshall Harlan is there. And I just think somebody whose parents name him John Marshall, who then lives up to it and ends up on the Supreme Court, deserves
incredible
painting. And seriously, all his pronouncements in a number of areas of the law, I think, are really remarkable.
He was a dissenter in Plessy, wasn't he?
Alone. That's when he said that we have a colorblind constitution. And the other one is Cardozo. At one time, I had five colleagues on the court from New York. So I figured I had to give them some New Yorker on the wall. And then, of course, the great chief, John Marshall, as well.
Yeah. So I read a speech that you gave to your son's graduating class that talked about the importance of getting to know the folks who work at the school, the custodial staff, the janitorial staff, those kinds of things. Why is that important? And why was it important enough for you to give that message to your son and his classmates?
Well, it was eighth grade, and it's a time when they need to learn a lot of things. I mean, it's important, just it's basic courtesy, but also it's important to appreciate that no matter high and mighty you might think you are or others might, that there are other people that are doing things that are just as vital to the functioning of our world and as anybody else. And all the people who work at the Supreme Court are part of the process that ends up in our articulation of what the law is. And whether it's the Chief Justice or somebody in the print shop or one of the law clerks or anybody else. And I think if you lose sight of that, that's a real shame. And, I do think, again, particularly eighth grade is a good place to learn that.
Did you do that when you were in school? Did you get to know those folks when you were in?
Oh, sure. Yeah. But in eighth grade, I mean, those people were the boss.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. You know, sometimes I'll have folks who are cleaning the office will come in and apologize to me for coming in and cleaning the office. And I said, if you folks don't do this, I can't do my job. So, you know, it's in, as you say, it's all.
Yeah, I apologize for making such a mess, which I usually do.
So you talked about a few minutes ago reading petitions for certiorari and briefs. What's the sort of criteria that you use for deciding whether you want to take a case? Other than writing about red dogs, what jumps out at you?
Well, and it's pretty clear that it doesn't really matter how right or wrong it is. I mean, the one thing you can say in a cert petition that's not a good idea is how horribly wrong this is, because the first message that comes across to us is that, well, if it's that wrong, we don't have to worry about it. Nobody's going to follow it. Mistake's been made, but one thing that's certain, it's not our job. We're not a court of error in the sense that we correct mistakes. So what we're looking for are conflicting decisions on the same law that have to be fixed. I mean, if one person reads this law and says you can't do this, and the other person says, no, it means you can't do this, It should mean the same thing across the country, and so that's more the type of case we would take to resolve that that disagreement. So people who want to get their cases heard need to have somebody who's good at explaining why we need a greater degree of uniformity. This, you know, you can't say in New York some particular expense is tax deductible, but in California it's not. So a lot of the cases we get are actually not that glamorous. They're not that interesting because there are a lot of areas of federal law, like, you know, patent law and copyright law, tax law, all sorts of things. And when those disagreements come up, we're the only ones who can fix it. So a lot of our docket is pretty mundane.
Is there something to, though, putting something in the cert petition that'll catch the judge's eye, like the Red Dog story? I mean, do you find yourself, when you read something like that that has something that catches your eye, drawn to it a little more?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, you know, we take whatever it is. I don't know what the number is, 1.5% of all the cert petitions. You've got to do something to stand out of the crowd, you know, unless you have a really good case. That may be enough to get our attention. But other than that, it makes sense. You have to be a good writer. If you're there, I mean, obviously our law clerks read somewhere all the petitions and they write summaries, but we read from those summaries ones that we think, you know, might be likely candidates. And, you know, it's very hard to pick out the right ones.
Some of your colleagues have written autobiographies. Have you started yours yet?
No.
Are you gonna?
No.
You will. Why? Why not?
I think my life is very interesting to me. I'm not sure it's terribly interesting to anyone else. And now that's not true of some of my colleagues. Justice Thomas's autobiography is absolutely gripping. If you haven't read it and are at all interested in the court, you should. It's such an extraordinary story. I really couldn't put it down. But I don't think I have that in me.
Let's talk about your role in terms of you as a public figure. Obviously, you're very recognizable. People know who you are. You have to be on all the time, like now. How do you separate that from your private life? How do you keep some privacy in your life and have this kind of bigger-than-life role as Chief Justice of the United States?
Well, recognizable. My wife and I were on vacation in Portugal last year, and another American sort of came up to us, and he's looking at me and says, "I know you. I know who you are. You're John Boehner." And so, you know, they were sitting next to me. I had to spend the whole evening pretending to be John Boehner. And so when you say readily recognizable, really not, to be honest with you. It's getting worse, though, in general, just because, you know, the work of the court is getting a higher degree of publicity. So it is a problem. I will say 99% of the interactions I've had with people, they come up and say hello, which is fine. And so that's good. But we're not as recognizable as you might think. Mm-hmm. Among a crowd of judges and lawyers, yeah, but in the public at large, not much of a problem.
So some of your colleagues have retired. You ever think about that? I mean, you're too young now, but someday, would you?
No.
No. Because you love what you do too much?
I'm going out feet first. Mm-hmm. It's just...
I am too.
Yeah, good. Well... Now I say that now. I mean, I'm sure if your health declines and all, and if you recognize that you're a burden to the court rather than part of an assist to everybody, then, you know, it'll be time to go. I have very good friends that were for a long time, many years, and I've sat down with them and you know, said I want, you know, at the appropriate time, because you don't always notice that you're slipping. I want the, you know, two of you to tell me if it's time to go. It's a long pause, and at once the two of them said, "It's time to go." So I said, "All right, never mind. I'll find you."
I have that deal with Chief Judge Wolford.
It is kind of surprising.
She's going to tell me. She hasn't said anything yet. Maybe after this she will.
It is surprising how rare it has been on the court for that to become an issue. Really just a handful of times. I think it's because it's a collegial, both in a technical sense and in a popular sense, group of people that you develop relationships where if the people do come, there have been times when somebody has stayed a little longer than they should, then the other colleagues come, and it's always really worked out. So I don't think that's going to be a problem. So, but it is, I still feel pretty healthy.
Yeah. Do you love what you do? I mean, you really look
I do.
Forward
it's exciting to get up, you know, every morning and go into work.
Doesn't seem like work when it's like that, right?
Some days. Some days it does. But it's nice that we have a break in the summer. Louis Brandeis, one of our great justices, said that he could do the 12 months worth of work in 10 months, but he couldn't do it in 12 months. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. We work at very close quarters on very important issues, on very sensitive issues, at work that is hard to do, and we do need a little break from each other.
Yeah.
But it does, it's interesting, it really is, creates such a strong bond. I'm sure people, you know, listening to the news or reading our decisions, particularly, you know, decisions that come out in May and June maybe, think, boy, those people really must, you know, hate each other. They must be at hammer and tong the whole time. We don't. I mean, the dealing with the type of cases we do and their significance, it's something only those nine people can know. Whether you take something as basic and fundamental as whether somebody lives or dies, you share that in a very intimate way, or whether whatever else that is the most important issue facing the public. And even if you are on opposite sides more often than not, and we're not, more of our decisions are unanimous than anything else, which people lose sight of, it is a strong bond.
I think when Justice Ginsburg and Justice Scalia were on the court together and their friendship got some publicity, I think people got to understand that a little bit more, because RBG was talked publicly about it a lot, and just how fond she was of Justice Scalia and vice versa, even though they were at opposite ends of lots of decisions.
Yeah, and a lot goes into that. And, you know, you have more in common with some colleagues than others.
Sure.
So I do things with some of my colleagues that I don't with the other, and vice versa. It is a bond. There are issues and discussions I don't share with my wife, and I know others don't, just because they find it easier not to know, you know, in terms of that, so they don't have to worry about it. It's a small group. The bonds of real affection and friendship and shared experience are very, very strong. I think we try very hard not to let disagreements of the moment break that.
So you've been on the court for 20 years?
Yeah.
And you were a circuit judge for a couple years before that?
Mm-hmm.
Read a lot of district court decisions over the years,
mm-hmm.
So I'm looking for a little advice now. what can you tell district judges about the decisions they write that might help us?
Yeah, brevity is good, and I think it's you know.
Are my law clerks listening to this?
Particularly with the district court, we recognize the primary responsibility of the district courts to deal with the facts. And we don't want to be second-guessing the facts. And so that's an important thing to address if it's going to be in the opinion, to make it clear what findings you've made about what and what hasn't. I remember Justice Rehnquist, for whom I clerk, was very adamant about that, and he was a very good trial lawyer. He said, you don't want to waste too much time, you know, on the law. The facts are more important than the law, and then, you know, as it moves up, people are focused more on the on the facts. He tried, when he was in my position as Chief Justice, he was remembering his days fondly as a trial lawyer, and he assigned himself to a district court in Virginia to hear a trial, just to kind of get back in the on the saddle in that way and stuff. And he did, and it was, he issued a decision, and they appealed, and the Fourth Circuit reversed him.
Is that right? And he never did it again.
No, but the only thing that made him mad, and he was really upset about it, is that they issued it as a per curiam opinion. Said nobody had the guts to put their name on it. But,
you ever think about doing that, trying to be a trial judge? No. Because, well, you didn't try cases, so
no
difference there. Yeah. So you became Chief Justice in 2005. You worked with Justice O'Connor. And then Justice Ginsburg.
Yeah.
And now there are more women on the court than ever. Has that changed the dynamic or the culture of the court in any way?
No. To be my honest answer, I don't think it has. I'm sure when Justice O'Connor came on as the first woman, it had all sorts of consequences and changes. And but, you know, now, to be honest, I don't think, in terms of the dynamic at conference or the discussions and all that, I just don't think it makes a difference. I wouldn't say that our conferences or our discussions are different because, I would say it's different because those particular individuals are there and they all come and bring different perspectives and all, but I don't think I would say it's different than because they're women.
Mm-hmm. So there's been a lot of criticism of some decisions because they have not, they've changed precedent, right? The abortion decision most recently and other decisions like that. But that happens all the time, right? I mean, there's lots of times when courts have precedent that they think needs to be changed for whatever reason. What kind of criteria do you apply to that yourself?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of misconception on that subject. See if I make sure I get these numbers right. A recent study, the Warren Court overruled, I think, 3.2 decisions on average, you know, a year.
Mm-hmm.
The Berger Court actually had a little bit more. I think they did 3.6% a year. The Rehnquist Court moved down a little bit, only 2.4 cases, not percent, cases a year. And in the past 20 years, the number's been 1.6. So people have a different, a somewhat wrong view of how many cases are being overturned. Now, we take fewer cases now than they did before, but the number of important ones that would be subject to overruling are the same. So a lot of people talk as if we're overruling a lot more. It's the lowest it's been since the 50s. Some cases should be. I mean, aren't you glad that, you know, Brown versus Board of Education overruled Plessy or that Katz overruled Olmstead? So the idea that it's invariably a bad thing to overrule precedent is I think, quite mistaken. At the same time, you can't do it willy-nilly. Just because, you know, you look at a case and you think, gosh, I would have had that principle come out the other way, that doesn't mean you overturn it. Stare decisis is an important part of our work. The law is supposed to be predictable. So you need a special justification before you want to overrule a case, other than that you just happen to think it's wrong.
We were talking about the Barnett case a little while ago, and that was a case that overruled a decision that Justice Frankfurter made just a few years before.
Gobitis or Gobitis,
And so, it's been around for a long time.
Yeah. So when you do that, the first thing has to be that it's clearly wrong. The second thing has to be, does that make a difference? I mean, if, for example, you say you can't figure out what the filing deadline is, you know, is it 10 days under the rule or is it 12 days? You have to decide it. But you shouldn't come back and say, oh, it should have been 12 days, not 10 days, so we're going to overrule that. I mean, that's something that Most cases, many cases, it's more important that they be decided than that they be decided right. Mm-hmm. Whether it's 10 or 12 days is a case like that. So it has to be a case where it really makes an important ongoing difference and be significant enough to the legal system that it's justified to overturn the approach. But it's not something you want to do very often.
Can you talk a little bit about your experience clerking for Judge Friendly and Justice Rehnquist?
Yeah, two wonderful years in my life and two totally different experiences. And I have to say, at a very personal level, the chance to clerk with Judge Friendly was very important. I graduated from law school in 1979. And this may be just the way I looked at it, but maybe it was because I, being a kind of lawyer was a second choice for me in general. The law was a very cynical enterprise back then, I think. And in some ways it's good and others bad. It was very instrumental. People were using law as kind of a vehicle to achieve a particular objective, which is nothing wrong with that at all. That's a lot of people, do that. But also in a cynical way. And law was not regarded as something of sort of moral value, for want of another word. And so I felt, frankly, that maybe this had not been a good choice. This wasn't something that was uplifting. If you had a particular agenda you wanted to pursue, it could help you do that. But then I went and, was at the elbow of this extraordinarily great man, one of the most remarkable judges, and he saw it differently. He really looked at it as a valuable gift that we had inherited for ordering society in a reasonable way. And he was somebody who was totally apolitical. The most brilliant judge of his generation, Richard Nixon, didn't appoint him to the Supreme Court because he thought he would be soft on crime. And he would have been, from Nixon's perspective. He would have applied the law as it should be, and it meant some criminals were going to go free and others weren't. And he was able to sort of construct, certainly in his opinions, which lawyers here know were remarkable, realized that this was a system that had internal coherence and that it was really a gift, and it needed people who are willing to view it in those terms rather than this is how I'm going to use it to get to a particular result. So that was where kind of I left my cynicism about the work that we as lawyers and judges do, and appreciated that it had a greater worth. And just in terms of writing, it was a remarkable, gifted writer. You would come off of the bench after argument and sit down with a legal pad, two of them, one for text, one for footnotes or notes, and just start writing and finish it in 1 day or 2 days. And the secretary would type it up and give it to one of his law clerks, and we'd look at it and say, well, what does he want us to do? And he would have some ideas and look at it. So that was a really remarkable year. And then with Rehnquist, Rehnquist was a generation between. Judge Friendly was kind of like almost like two generations. He was older, and I was just out of law school, and Rehnquist was kind of right in the middle. A different approach. His writing is crystal clear, very direct, had the same sort of appreciation and, I don't mean to overuse these sorts of words, but reverence for what the law does, but was very, direct and analytic, and you sort of knew exactly how it was structured and where it was going. So it was a nice experience for me to have two very different people, and they really admired each other. In fact, I got the clerkship with Rehnquist because he and Friendly were at a conference together. And I think, Justice Rehnquist asked Judge Friendly if he had any good law clerks, and he mentioned one, and I guess somebody else hired that one, and then he mentioned I don't mean to be long-winded about it, but you do kind of look back at that and see these sort of formative influences in your life and are grateful for them.
Does the way you deal with your clerks, by and large, mirror the way they dealt with you?
No, I wouldn't say that. When you're in the middle of it, it's kind of hard to be self-conscious and appreciate. The one thing I do know is that the four clerks really do form quite a common bond. And Rehnquist used to talk to us about how that was, and he said it's because the clerks are united by a common enemy. It's kind of hard when you're in the middle of it to see how, you know, they might view the experience.
How do you work with your clerks? How do you?
It really varies from case to case. You know, sometimes if the facts are a little complicated, I'll want them to take a look at the record more than they might otherwise. Sometimes if I feel comfortable that I know the law in an area, I'll have them do that. But I would go in much more carefully because I'm probably wrong about it. I want to make sure that I'm not letting, you know, errors that might have crept in affect my understanding. And then we'll go back and forth. Sometimes I'll draft something and they'll look at it, and they don't have the problem I had with Judge Friendly. Their edits come back pretty extensive sometimes.
And you encourage that, right? I mean, I'm sure you ask them.
Well, and what's the point otherwise, right?
Right, exactly.
And sometimes I'll want to look at the facts a little bit more. But then when we get closer to the end, I have all four of them sit down together, and we all go over the draft of the opinion. So you have somebody who's sort of been looking at it very carefully. Hopefully I'm one of those people too. And then the others who have just kind of like read it. So in a way, it's like, you know, when I talked about doing briefs, you want to make sure that someone sort of putting eyes on it for the first time can really figure out what it says.
How do you decide which clerk works on which case?
I leave that entirely up to them.
They make those decisions.
Yeah, yeah.
You always happy with the decisions they make?
No.
Well, you still don't put your thumb on the scale?
To be honest, they're all extremely bright. It's a real gift that the system has developed where we get these very, very bright people to work very, very hard, and they come up with such great work products. So,
And when you hire clerks, have they generally clerked for a district judge or a circuit judge first?
Oh, sure.
Always?
Yeah. Always, yeah.
So unlike Justice White, who...
That was kind of the fading out of that experience, I think. And, you know, you want to get the view of a judge who's been with them for a year, I think, because that helps a lot.
Mm-hmm. And one-year clerkships?
Absolutely.
Why?
You don't want them to get too good. I mean, that's the case. No, very seriously. I mean, you don't want them to get too good at what you're supposed to do. You want to make sure that you are the one doing the work. Yes, they're going to help you on what the cases say about this or how the facts look on this issue, but you don't want them to get too good because...
And because you think there's a danger of you using them as a crutch too much.
Yeah, you want to make sure that issue doesn't really come up.
Yeah.
Also it's a real valuable thing for me, and I know other justices, to have these sorts of to be a little more attuned to what's going on in the law schools, and, you know, having a fresh batch every year, you learn more about, you know, what the teachers are teaching and what the students are interested in, and then they go out. So I have now people that clerked for me 20 years ago. They're in the midst of their professional career, leaders in the bar, or leaders in academia, or leaders in business, and they're real sort of listening boards. We have a reunion every year. It's coming up in a couple of weeks. Hopefully we'll have a good turnout. We usually do, and you learn from them all that's going on. You know, what's going on in the law firms, and the people who are there will let you know. What are they teaching in law schools these days? And they'll let you know. What are you teaching in law schools these days? And it's nice to have that pipeline. I mean, now I have almost 100 out there at different stages, and it keeps you attuned to what's going on.
Yeah, I mentioned to you earlier today that I have you to thank, you and Dave Lebron, who is the president of the Review, to thank for my clerkship. You sent me to, or suggested that I apply to Judge Irvin Goldberg down in Dallas, Texas. And that was the best professional year of my life because, as I said to you earlier today, it was a wonderful experience kind of being a judge, but not having the buck stop with you. So the pressure's not there, but the wonderful part of the job is. And that makes clerking, I think, a really unique experience. So let's get to the our time is running out. Let's get to the heart of what I want to talk to you about. There's a lot of Buffalo Bills fans here. And when the playoffs come around, there's a lot of calls that go against us. Are you going to be around to handle some emergency appeals this season? You know, we're getting tired of the same old thing happening to us year after year.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. Well, I was here long enough. I know I had a poster in my room of Jack Kemp, mm-hmm. quarterback, and I think Daryl LaMonica was there.
Yep.
Too.
Yep.
And Pete Gogolak, who was the first soccer-style
yep.
kicker. Even Cookie Gilchrist, if I'm remembering that.
Yep.
So that was what was posted on my wall. But I left when I was 10.
Yep.
And we moved to, you know, a town in Indiana. Chicago was the closest place. So,
so you're a Bears fan?
I'm a Bears fan. but look, when I was growing up, it was Dick Butkus, Mike Ditka, and really, if he hadn't blown out his knee, the greatest running back in NFL history, Gale Sayers. And we were near, they had different connections with, they would come and talk at our grade school even, and because we were in Indiana, but on the lake, and people liked to go there. And it was just...
Yeah, I say Gale Sayers, I think, was the most beautiful runner I've ever seen. He just was so graceful. And so much fun to watch, and it was a shame that he blew out his knee.
Yeah, I have a signed helmet of his. Not of his, it's a Bears helmet that he signed in my chambers.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. This is an honor for me, and this was a very pleasurable hour. So.
Well, not at all. Thank you for having me, giving me the opportunity to go back and see my boyhood home and, you know, kindle memories of Buffalo. I appreciate it.
We're proud that
thank
you're from
you all
here.
For being
proud
here.
Proud that you're from here. Thanks.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
I'm Emma Greed, and I've spent the last 20 years building, running, and investing in some incredible businesses. The more success I've had, the more people started coming to me with questions. How do you start a business? How do you raise money? How do I bounce back from failure? On my new podcast, Aspire with Emma Greed, I'll be answering these questions and more through weekly conversations with the smartest minds out there. Listen to and follow Aspire with Emma Greed, an Audacy podcast, available now, wherever you get your podcasts.